The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the fourth event of the Arts on the Mind Festival, titled Travelers to Unimaginable Lands. My name is Miles. I'm the Artistic Director of the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society, and the Chamber Music Society, along with the Penn Memory Center, have joined forces to create this wonderful six-event festival that focuses on understanding the power of the arts to explore the human mind. And at the central crux of this all is the question, how can the arts help us understand and support our minds as we age? For those of you that are not familiar, hopefully you've got our program books, but the inspiration for Arts on the Mind is the Philadelphia premiere of Mark Nykrug's A Song by Mahler, which is going to be on Wednesday, May 15th at 7:30 at the Perlman Theater. So tonight's event features two fantastic clinicians and authors that we're very excited to have here with you. Dasha Kuiper has written Travelers to Unimaginable Lands. She's a clinical psychologist, educator, and author. She'll be in conversation with someone we know very well here now at the Chamber Music Society, and that's Dr. Jason Karlowish, who is not only affiliated with the Penn Memory Center, but is a professor of medicine, medical ethics, health policy, and neurology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, his book, The Problem with Alzheimer's. So they'll go back and forth discussing their books and topics that are related to them. Before we turn things over to them, I have some people to thank, so bear with me, but we would not be here without them. The first is one of the more unsung heroes, in my opinion, of the scene off stage here in Philadelphia is Andy Kahane, director of author events here at the Philadelphia Free Library. And because Andy has worked at the Free Library for almost as long as I have, we have known each other for a while now, and it really was a tremendous opportunity for us to work with him, and his support has been most appreciated. We would not be here tonight without a group of individuals and two or three foundations. So let me read them all, and then we'll give them a round of applause all together. The lead sponsors are the Greenfield Foundation. They came in after we had already started our funding drive, and they were really instrumental in getting us over the top. With their support, their belief in this project, but the actual true kind of inspiration for all of what we're doing today comes from the Alan R. and Judy Brick Friedman Venture Fund. So Alan and Judy are here. They've been incredible in believing in this project from the beginning. They saw A Song by Mahler out in Santa Fe. They said, let's get it to Philadelphia. And then once I said, okay, let's do that, they said, well, what else are you going to do? That led to building this incredible festival, which also led to the connection with Jason and the Penn Memory Center. Huge thank you to them. We are indebted to them very much so. Constance and Michael Cohn have also been very generous and not listed on your program books, but they've just given us money. And it's worth mentioning because they've been very generous is the William Penn Foundation. The last thing I will say is if you do not have either one of these books, you are in luck, because Uncle Bobby's is here, and we are selling Travelers to Unimaginable Lands and The Problem with Alzheimer's upstairs, and Jason and Dasha will sign their books and meet and greet anybody. So without any further ado, will you please help me welcome to the stage Dasha Kuiper and Dr. Jason Karlow.
All right, well, good evening. I'm Jason Karlowish, and I'm the co-director of the Penn Memory Center, and resident of Philadelphia as well. I live just up the street near the Eastern State Penitentiary. So I'm here with Dasha Kuiper, the author of Travelers to Unimaginable Lands, Stories of Dementia, the Caregiver, and the Human Brain. Dasha began her career in dementia disorders when, for 1 year, she became the live-in care partner for Mr. Kessler, who we'll hear more about him later. And that experience led to over a decade of her work supporting caregivers. Currently, she provides counseling and support groups for caregivers. She works for Renewal Memory Partners. And she also trains and supervises mental health professionals who work with families affected by dementia. And her experience has very much led to this book. And it's a Travelers to Unimaginable Lands. Stories of Dementia, The Caregiver in the Human Brain, weaves stories, really well-told stories, and very well-rendered brain science to illuminate the neurological and the existential challenges of caring for someone with dementia. In the foreword of the book, the physician and author Norman Dodge describes this book as bibliotherapy. It's a healing text. Central to that healing is Kipper's very original concept of dementia blindness. And I'm going to have her explain dementia blindness in a moment. But first, I do want to put this event in context with the other events that are part of the Arts of the Mind Festival. So, across the street, across the parkway at the Franklin Institute on the 13th of March at Music, Meaning, and the Brain, we learned about how the brain and the environment together create mind. And then we learned from Ann Basting how the creative arts can allow us to connect with the mind, especially the mind that is changed or, dare I even say, damaged by a disease like Alzheimer's. So today with Dasha, we're going to learn more about how diseases such as Alzheimer's transform the mind of a person that I call, because I'm a physician, patients, and also the mind of the person that we commonly call a caregiver. Let me remind you, the word caregiver didn't really exist before 1980. There's a whole story about that. Now, I'm going to have to give you a warning, though, about our time together tonight. This is going to get a little vivid. We're talking about a disease, and I don't think any conversation about a disease is pleasant, entertaining, conversational topic, whether that's acne, cancer, or sinusitis. But we're not here just to be entertained. We're here to learn. We want to learn how to live well with disabling cognitive impairments. So I'll promise you that at the other end of this conversation will be some rewards, that you're going to leave here inspired to read her book and gain an even greater understanding of why it can be so difficult to live with dementia, whether you're a patient or a caregiver. And with that understanding, to live well with it even. So let's get going. But first, I think we wanted to clarify some terms. Dasha and I both agreed that the one thing about this disease, this problem of dementia, is just basic nomenclature things. So what's dementia? Let's talk about that quickly. I would say that dementia is disabling cognitive impairments that are progressive over time. Does that resonate?
Sure does.
Okay. Now, by disabling, though, I'm not meaning physical disability, which is when we think of disability, we right away go to physical, right? Yeah. Knees aren't working, whatever, or eyes. But here it's that the higher cortical function is becoming impaired, and so someone has troubles doing things like paying bills, preparing a meal, using transportation, and then later on, troubles with bathing, dressing, grooming, and feeding. Is that, okay, yeah. So that's dementia.
That's dementia.
All right. So what's Alzheimer's?
Well, Alzheimer's is the disease, because dementia is not a disease. It is a cluster of symptoms that potentially can explain a disease, whether it's Alzheimer's or Lewy body or...
So is Alzheimer's the only cause of dementia?
Unfortunately not. There are many different kinds of dementias. There's Lewy body, there's frontal temporal disease. There are many different kinds of dementia disorders, and oftentimes more than one.
And dementia has stages.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what would describe the typical early stage patient, mild stage patient? What would that profile be? Back to the disability idea.
So. Anytime a caregiver asks me this, I always get nervous because it manifests itself in so many different ways. But usually earlier moderate stages, there is quite a bit of independence that somebody who has a dementia disorder is capable of. They could still do some shopping. They could still go out. In many ways, a lot of their talents are preserved. And this is why a lot of people with dementia can continue working, and sometimes in very sophisticated high offices. And it's because a lot of their unconscious skills are preserved, and they could look very similar to anybody else.
Okay. But then, of course, over time, these diseases typically we call them neurodegenerative diseases, a very simple term, but it's describing neurons not working well and dying. Over time, the disabilities can progress such that people have more troubles doing daily activities like cooking, shopping, using technology like the computer, and even troubles then later on with problems with, say, picking out clothing, putting it on.
For sure,
Okay. All right, well, that's a pithy overview of key terms. Let's wrap up with an easy term, and then we'll dive in. Mind, what's mind? And 2 hours later, they wrapped it up. No, but
But because I'll give you my idea. I think that mind is the ability to have experiences in the world.
Yeah.
So, for example, Miles Cohen from Philadelphia Chamber Music Society talked about how in 2 weeks you're all going to come and see Mark Nacrug's A Song by Mahler. And I expect that at the end of A Song by Mahler, you're going to feel a very interesting set of sensations of grief mixed with hope and a deeper sense of what is love. And I think that's your mind in action. And that's a very unique activity of our brain. And our minds, as you point out in your book, have, I love this word, an urgent priority, namely to maintain a connection with other people.
Yeah.
That's what human mind, we're doing it right now, I think.
We are
I
indeed.
We're doing a good job. Yeah. And I think there's some going on here too. I felt a little connection there. And of course, what happens in dementia is that there's some troubles perceiving mind.
Definitely.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, because when a human mind meets another human mind, and that's almost a redundant statement, because you know, humans have a mind, it immediately does something very funny. It engages in mind perception.
That's right.
So what does it mean to engage in mind perception? How are you perceiving my mind?
I think that what happens is that our mind, first of all, we click in, because our biology's number one priority is to create connection. So the minute I meet you, I'm trying to get on your page. I'm trying to establish that connection. I'm trying to share in that world, because that's the only way our minds can be productive.
Right.
And that is not only a good feeling, it is actually cognitively restorative. Because when minds connect, it also helps our cognition, it helps our well-being, it helps absolutely everything, because that is our biology's greatest imperative, is to connect.
I think it helps us survive.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, because we kind of use other people.
Yeah, yeah. Our minds cannot function in isolation, because we cannot function with the stress of isolation.
Right.
So
our minds don't stop at our skull. No.
No. They do not.
Yeah. There are these amoeba, that's not right, because amoebas don't have minds. There are these parasitic-like things that go out into the world and use all kinds of toys and tools and people. So now let's introduce dementia, disabling cognitive impairments, into the mix. Because something goes wrong with this basic human function between two people.
That's right.
And you have this idea of dementia blindness.
Yeah.
And this is a very central concept in the book that organizes the many fascinating stories that you tell. So let's talk about what dementia blindness is. Go ahead.
Yeah. So dementia blindness is a term I coined to explain a curious and oftentimes baffling tendency that caregivers have. And one of those tendencies is that it takes them a very long time to notice that dementia symptoms are there. This is why so many caregivers tell me, well, my husband has had dementia for 5 years. Well, actually, now that I think of it, and then they go back, I missed a lot. It's probably been about 10 or 12.
Right.
So that's one of the first things that I'm constantly hearing. The other thing I'm hearing, and this is another form of blindness, is when dementia caregivers call me, they're calling me in distress. And their distress oftentimes has a lot more to do with them than their partner. They say, I'm changing in ways I can't recognize. I expected my husband to change, but I'm changing because I know my husband has a disease. I've read all the literature.
Right.
I've spoken to my doctor. I've read the guidebooks. But when I am with him, it's like the disease goes away, and my expectations are still such that this is my husband. And as a result, I get angry with him. I still expect him to be the way he's always been. And then I feel so much shame and guilt, because later on I'm saying, what are you doing? The man has dementia. Why are you asking him, don't you remember? Why are you holding him accountable? Why are you yelling at him for not doing the things he would definitely forget to do? And so dementia caregivers are oftentimes torn between what they know intellectually to be true
and
emotionally how they feel when they're sitting in front of the person they're supposed to take care of. And what I find is that dementia caregivers beat themselves up because they think, well, clearly it's because I'm just not nice enough. Clearly it's because I'm not patient enough. Clearly it's because I'm stubborn, in denial, selfish. And my job is to assure them that, first of all, this happens to everybody. Every single dementia caregiver I've spoken to has fallen into the same pitfalls. And then I had to take it upon myself, and I thought, well, why does it happen to everybody? And when I began to study about the human brain, I began to understand, oh, they're reacting like this because it's actually a natural, adaptive way to react to another mind.
So so let's give some examples.
Yeah.
So that's our theoretical structure. I told you it's going to get pretty intense.
So brace yourself.
Yeah, let's go to chapter one, titled Borges in the Bronx.
Yeah.
And I deliberately made sure I said the check, because we're going to come back later, because I think one of the things that you're also going to pick up from this book when you read it is Dasha very thoughtfully uses literature, not just as a way to embellish and give a little color, but to actually help you make sense of her ideas. But we'll come back to that point later. Borges in the Bronx opens your chapter and opens your book. And I thought it's a great opener because it takes on the stereotypical symptom of Alzheimer's disease, which is memory loss, you know, the repetitious questions, et cetera. So let's go to that chapter and that stereotypical symptom of dementia blindness, that stereotypical symptom of memory loss and how dementia blindness manifests in that case. And you talk about it's the story of Mr. Kessler and his son. And this is a gentleman that you lived with for a year.
I did.
Yeah, so tell us about how dementia blindness revealed itself with respect to with memory loss. Go ahead.
Sure, yeah. So dementia blindness will reveal itself in absolutely every chapter, but I began, this is the first chapter and I'm part of the story, so I got to observe it firsthand. What I found when I spoke to Sam, the son who was taking care of his father, is that firstly, he grossly underestimated the stage that his father was in. And that's true of all caregivers. I always think that we're always a couple of steps behind. And later I found out that his father actually had dementia symptoms for years, but Sam didn't know it. And lots of us could say, how can you miss something as profound and as important as memory? Shouldn't it be obvious? And
memory loss.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Shouldn't it be obvious? But the more I got to understand their relationship, and the more I got to understand how the mind works, I realized that it's actually not as obvious as we think. So a typical interaction with father and son is, and this is before his son realized his father had dementia, is he'd walk into the home, he would see a bunch of nutty things happening in the home that I'm sure many of you would recognize. There's laundry detergent in the oven, he's not shaven, he's not clean. So the first thing he's seeing that he has been working with electric appliances that are dangerous. So his son tells him, Dad, you've got to shower. Dad, you've got to clean up. And then he would start, you know, and Mr. Kessler would start arguing. I showered yesterday. No, Dad, you didn't. How do you know this? I was here yesterday. No, you weren't. Right? So he doesn't.
I'm feeling the tension.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm giving you the PG-13 version of that tension. But what's interesting is Sam later on said, man, I should have realized my father had, memory loss. But what's actually happening is he's hearing is the same father who was always argumentative, who denied reality at every turn, who refused to think that he did anything wrong, and who automatically dismissed his son's ideas. That was part of their dynamic.
For years,
exactly. Right. And so when I think about why does it take us so long to see dementia symptoms, even when it stares us in the face, this has a lot to do, actually, with the way that our brain works. A lot of people say, oh, it's denial. And partly it could be denial, which is fine. But part of it is our brain has a very interesting, stubborn tendency that when it looks out into the world, when it sees the world and the people in it, it is not taking the people in the world objectively. It's not just seeing what's out there. That's not the job. Our brain's job is not to be an accurate reporter. What it does is that it edits what we see to fit into our expectations. Does that mean that we're sometimes wrong? It certainly does. But being accurate is not our brain's priority. Having a coherent picture is. So it's much easier to edit what we're seeing to make it look like the past.
And that we think should be the past.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right.
Right.
And what that means is that we miss a lot of things that are new because our brain oftentimes edits out the new things to make them look much more to fit our expectations. So we're always walking around the world and our brain is working unconsciously to make everything and the people in it meet our expectations. So when Sam was talking with his father, getting into his usual arguments, he's not seeing new disease, new symptoms, memory loss. Oh, no. His brain is editing the picture, editing this interaction to say, oh, that's just Dad. blaming me for everything, arguing about everything, stubborn, could never admit he's wrong, and still thinks he's self-sufficient because he's always believed he's self-sufficient, right?
So this is the idea of what we call in neuropsychology episodic memory.
That's right.
Right, which is, just think about what an episode is. It's a yet another, you know, season 3, episode 4 of Bridgerton, you know, which builds on season 3, episode 1 and 2.
Exactly.
And, you know, the episodes tied together into a story. And when we make episodic memories, they're not these perfect recollections of everything.
Yeah.
They're a very edited account of what mattered to us, what had meaning to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the emphasis here is on meaning.
Exactly.
Oftentimes because of the emotions of the events.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, if you ask people sort of, you know, how was a major holiday a year ago, it's going to be the meaningful events around that holiday, not the detail of where the cranberry sauce was.
Absolutely.
Which is why you use Borges in the Bronx, because this is where Dasha's really, really smart, is it's Borges's story, Funes the Memorist.
Yeah.
And what's Funes's, what was his problem?
He remembered everything.
He had a perfect memory.
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't you want to have a perfect memory? You don't. No. You want to forget.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the points you're bringing out, which is that that is the way the normal human brain is. It actually lives to forget.
Yeah.
And remember only what we want to remember.
Right. Yeah.
And if you have, and if normal people get together, that's called a functioning couple.
That's exactly right.
Right. Yeah. But if one of us has episodic memory problems, we have an even more damaged episodic memory, and yet I'm thinking yours is still good, and so we start fighting. We're not going to fight, but
we'll try not to.
No. So that's a cognitive ability, as we say, like, you know, memory. You know, I give you. And actually, it's funny. One of our best tests for Alzheimer's disease, symptomatic Alzheimer's disease, the best test for Alzheimer's disease is to measure amyloid and tau in the brain. But we'll talk about that when one of us publishes our next book.
Sure.
But the best test for symptomatic Alzheimer's disease is what we call a test of episodic memory, where we actually read a story to a person.
Mm-hmm.
Ask them to say it back to us, and then do some other cognitive activity. And then we have, what was that story I told you? And we actually score how many bits of the story they remember of that episodic story. Because we think that telling people a story is a great way to really test our memory.
Yeah.
So that's one example of dementia blindness playing out with that classic symptom.
Yeah, and so dementia hides behind the old family dynamic that the son expected it. And dementia disorders are very sneaky. There is no trait that your family has that's annoying, hurtful, wounding, that dementia cannot hide behind, and where the caregiver can't say, oh, that's not a symptom. That's just my mom being undermining.
Now remember, I said this was going to get vivid and even a little ugly. We're going to redeem it in the end, because we're going to talk about some ways we can learn to...
Yes.
The first step towards learning to live with something is understanding.
Yeah, we're not just here to depress you.
Exactly. But I think you're getting at a very important point already, which is that the mind of these two people are very interconnected.
They sure are.
And so what happens... So we spend a lot of time focusing on the... And again, I use this word in provocatively... the damaged mind of the person with Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like you think that there's something going on with the mind of the caregiver.
Yes.
What's going on?
And that's another reason, this other thing that I think is so important is another reason why we're blinded. And I'll use another example to demonstrate this. There's a caregiver who I recently spoke to who I absolutely adore. She is taking care of her mother, and her mother has paranoia. Seems simple. It's a very clear, very abrasive version of paranoia. And her mother's specific paranoia is that her daughter is stealing her money. And in addition to that, she has garden variety memory loss, and she believes that her daughter does absolutely nothing in her house, just sleeps all day. Now, the outsider could say, well, that's just memory loss. She doesn't remember, so she just assumes you sleep all day. And this caregiver came to me crying because she said, and this is one of the most even-tempered, gentle women I have ever met, she said that I started yelling like an animal at my mom after a while. And this woman's social worker was getting annoyed. She's like, I'm going to call her Julia. I keep telling Julia to stop having expectations of your mother. She's like, she can't remember. Why are you yelling at her? But every time her mom said, you know, you don't do anything around the house, you just sleep all day, she would start saying, no, this is what we're doing. I gave you a bath. We went to the bank. And she would start listing everything. And she's like, I know I'm being ridiculous, but I feel possessed every time I read it. And when she, when her mother accused her of stealing her money, that deeply angered her for many reasons. First of all, she had to give up her job, so she's losing money.
Her money is somehow being stolen.
Yes. Yeah. Her mother just got it. She just got it wrong as to who's at fault. But so it was very, very painful that she has committed all these sacrifices. And for the social worker I spoke to, she's like, I just don't know what to tell Julia because she keeps acting the same way. She's like, she's becoming more insane and more irrational than her mother. And I think that one of the most important things we understand is that dementia symptoms, they don't just affect or change the brain of the person who has the disease. They truly affect and change the caregiver's brain. And the reason for that is because our brain has a stubborn, relentless, automatic desire to connect. That is its number one priority. More than being reasonable, more than accuracy, more than facts, it has a desire to connect. So Julia, who's very well aware that her mom has Alzheimer's, she was a good student, went to all the lectures, but when her mom accuses her, what her brain registers is the fact that I don't see you, we do not share in the same reality. I am not only not connected to you, you're a danger to me. And our social brains, as a reaction to that, feel themselves in danger. So intellectually, we might know there's nothing going on, but emotionally, what happens is your executive functioning brain is not being consulted. The threat goes straight into the amygdala, and then you react. And so it seems like, oh, what's wrong? Why is it so hard not to argue with people who have dementia? Why is it so hard to inhabit their reality? Well, forget the fact that most caregivers are extremely sleep deprived, which does not, which usually does not, you know, make us the kindest people. But also the fact that what dementia disorders do ultimately is they deeply undermine the number one goal, our biological imperative to connect. Every single symptom, whether it's hallucinations, whether it's paranoia, whether it's memory loss, all those symptoms remind the caregiver, you are alone. They're not in your world. Your job is to get into theirs, possibly, but you don't share a world. And that is deeply, deeply threatening. And it doesn't just make us feel bad. When our brain feels isolated, what happens is our own cognition is damaged, our own ability to emotionally regulate ourselves, that means don't scream at your mom, are impaired, our attention span, our ability to work and engage and have flexibility and have kindness and not take things personally, all that decreased because of isolation. And the irony is, of course, all the things that caregivers need to do, be patient, be flexible, are being taken away because they're in a deeply isolated state.
You know, it's interesting when I listen to this, I think by now most of you would probably say, well, gee, we should probably take caregivers very seriously in the healthcare system. Yeah, you got it. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting. In fact, you know, in the electronic medical record, it's hard. We don't obviously designate them. You know, for example.
Yeah.
There's been arguments made that if someone has someone who's in the role of caregiver, which it's easy to know one, but it's hard to define who they are.
Yeah.
But having said that, that there should be a medical record opened as well for the caregiver.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is not the norm. Yeah. You can't. I have colleagues who will see caregivers as clinicians, so they're taking care of the patient, they're billing 331.00, which is an ICD-9 code, you know, et cetera. But it's clear that the caregiver needs attention, and so what they'll do is they'll see the caregiver separately, and they'll bill it as an adjustment disorder is the popular diagnosis to use there to give them care. Let's talk about one other example, and then we're going to pivot to some as we've gained this greater understanding about dementia blindness, then we're going to pivot to some sort of things we can do now.
Mm-hmm.
So the other example you mentioned already, so we've talked about memory loss, we've talked about distortions of reality. I want to talk about one other one, which is, you tell in the story of Jasmine and her mother, Pat. Pat is the person living with dementia. Jasmine's her daughter. And the problem here is that Jasmine says to you, in a rhetorical question, does dementia make people selfish? What was going on in that story that would reveal dementia blindness? And your response, of course, is that it doesn't. There's something else. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the reason that Jasmine asked me, does dementia make people selfish, is because every day Jasmine asked her mom to do one thing. She was accommodating to her mom when it came to absolutely everything. But there's one thing that Jasmine asked her mom. Mom, please leave my food alone. Which seems like no big deal, but Jasmine had suffered from an eating disorder for a very long time, and it wouldn't take Freud to reveal the fact that her mom was a major part of why she had developed that eating disorder. So it's the one thing that Jasmine needed for her sanity, and her mother wouldn't give it to her. And of course, any doctor or clinician would say, of course she can't do that for you, she forgets. Right, she can't follow. She's going to argue. She's going to say that you're ridiculous, and she's just going to undermine your needs. And so when Jasmine said, "Does dementia make you selfish?" what she's responding to is, "I keep asking my mom for this one thing. So does dementia make you selfish?" And my answer, and I regretted it. My answer was like, "Well, technically not. It's that, and we know research now that people with dementia have a very hard time with theory of mind, which is being able to hold other people's needs.
Perceiving
their emotions. Right. But emotionally, when somebody doesn't have theory of mind, what they appear to you is just a jerk who doesn't care about you. I mean, that is emotionally what it feels like to be Jasmine. And I think that when I told her, well, technically not, Jasmine said, maybe not, but it feels exactly the same. And it does. Because Jasmine is not in a relationship with her mother's hippocampus. She's in a relationship with her mother. And so that's the reason body diseases are, while devastating, kind of intuitive. We understand when lungs fail. We understand when thyroids fail, when kidneys fail. It's sad, but it makes sense. But when brains fail, we can intellectually understand that, but to treat a mind like a failing body is very hard because we still have expectations of minds. Because we're such deeply social creatures, and those expectations that we have of minds is to have accountability, that's very big, and to have a shared connection. And so Allison was suffering that her mom was not giving her that. She was not giving her that connection and respect, that I see you, I know this is what you need. And so that pain is very deep, and it's automatic, despite her intellectual understanding of where it comes from. Right. Because a lot of these things are, they are visceral and they're automatic, whereas intellectual understanding is slow and abstract.
Yeah. And if there's a theme that's running through our conversation and in your book is something which, you know, I think as... For whatever reason, you know, the cortex was viewed mistakenly as the rational bit, and then below it is this sort of reptilian brain, and which, of course, I think neuroscience has clearly shown that distinction is just a sort of cultural construct to make us feel like we're in control. But our emotions and our cognitive processes work in intimate collusion together to make us be who we are.
Exactly.
So let's pivot a bit now, how this understanding can be put to use, can help. I think, you know, let me ask you this question then. Is the goal to change the mind of the person with dementia?
Well, of course not, in the sense that...
What is the goal then?
I think the goal, and I would say the goal when it comes to human beings in general. We talk about like how we treat people with dementia special, but it's actually, I think my opinion is like that's the ideal for how you treat people in general. The goal is not to change them. The goal is to understand them.
Yeah,
and to emotionally validate them, which is a much easier said than done.
yeah. Well, you've made an interesting observation there. It's not like much of what you're saying is sort of like a stress test on normal human interactions.
Yeah.
You know, dementia just sort of, it's sort of like, well, what's it like when a flood occurs? Well, let's have a tidal wave happen. Then we'll really know what a flood's like here.
Yeah.
Or, you know, what's it like when to be isolated? Well, let's have a pandemic and see what happens over a year and what the effects of, et cetera. So these awful, it's kind of an awful natural experiment.
Yeah.
There is, by the way, I think a theme in your book, which is I sense a lot of the folks that you care for have been long in the diagnosis and not really gotten much care.
I wish that was only a theme in my book.
What do you mean?
I find that so many caregivers I speak to.
This is what I see too, which is kind of like, you know, we kind of call ourselves the court of last resort, which is people have been endlessly going through a system that just never got them the justice they needed until they finally show up at the memory center or show up at Reveal Memory Partners.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine a world where these problems were thought about in a proactive way.
I know.
You know, before, you know, you've had years of injury occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So let's pivot to some Bartleby the Scrivener.
Yes.
So I've never read it. Melville mm-hmm. of Moby Dick fame, one of his books. But this is one of many examples in the book. So let's talk about, I think one thing I took away, and when you read her book, Dasha's book, she gives you a couple very books that you also want to read and or stories. And I've never read Bartleby, but now I want to, because while it is not a story of a caregiver-patient dyad,
mm-hmm.
you render it in a way that gives great understanding to further understand the caregiver-patient dyad. And in brief, it's the story of a young man who's a wonderful scrivener back before the days of copiers and whatnot, who works for a lawyer on Wall Street and is a great copier, but then one day just simply decides that he's no longer going to do his job. And what does he say?
I prefer not to.
And to add to his apathy, he also refuses to leave the office.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
To the point that the lawyer finally gets a new office.
Yes. It devolves very quickly.
Yeah. It's actually sounds like wonderful, sort of almost surrealist fiction.
It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. Almost like a story about a white whale and this captain who's chasing. And you use this story to sort of posit we could see Bartleby as a person living with dementia.
Yeah.
And the lawyer as a frustrated caregiver. Who ultimately walks into a dilemma. And what is that dilemma that you see played out in that story?
Yeah. The dilemma is that, like so many caregivers, on the one hand, and he's not going to use any of the modern terms I'm going to use, so forgive me. On the one hand, he thinks that this man clearly has a problem, right? He's like, he thinks that he is, I mean, they might have used the word touched or
yeah.
that there's a...
He's nuts.
Yeah, he's nuts. And he can't, and the goal is he can't help himself. And that disarms the lawyer because, well, what do you do with somebody who can't help themselves? Well, then they
help them.
You help them. They earn our compassion and you accommodate them. But then there's another side of him that feels like, no, there's something perverse about this man. He is goading me. He's doing this on purpose.
He's criminal.
He's criminal.
There's maliciousness.
I'm trying to give him everything because at this point, the lawyer is turning himself upside down, trying to make this man's life easier. And he just keeps saying, I prefer not to. And like so many caregivers, I feel I identified with him as a former caregiver is you try so hard to be useful. And I think that is the tragedy. You're trying so hard to connect and be useful, and at every turn, you're being rejected. And again, intellectually, you might know something is off, but your biology, your nervous system, it doesn't know.
Yeah.
What it knows is that it hurts, it's pissed, and you have no idea how to fix the situation. So he's constantly caught between, do I indulge this poor man, or do I get him out of my life, and he could make his own decisions because he is willful and mean and perverse.
And in the lives of caregivers, I think both of us, when we were chatting beforehand, this plays out in a, I've heard it, you've heard it. Is it her or is it the disease?
Yes.
Because if it's her, then issues of blameworthiness, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
and it becomes very awkward. And
yeah.
you know, if it's the disease, well, you can take pity and et cetera. But the more you think it's the disease, especially if it's a problem of the mind,
yeah.
you're objectifying the individual and you're reducing them to their
yeah.
disease.
Yeah. yeah. And that is
one of, I think, the dilemmas that we face.
And yeah. that's why I think caregivers are so loath to make decisions on behalf of people they're caring for.
Yeah.
A lot of people say, oh, you're procrastinating, you're being irrational, it's time for you to take that driver's
license
away.
No, but I want him to be agentive.
Yes, exactly. But yeah. I think that, you know... Yeah.
So let's pivot to the arts
yeah.
a bit. Because so we did talk about the arts already. We've talked about Bartleby the Scrivener.
Yeah.
We talked about Funes the Memorious. Waiting for Godot is given a rendition, which has me want to go back and read Waiting for Godot.
Oh, I'm delighted.
Yeah, no. We've got Uncle Vanya, I believe, is invoked. Yeah, so you'll leave here with a reading list of works that were never written to be about what it's like to be a person living with dementia or their caregiver. But what are some other roles for the arts? And I came away, so if the issue is that dementia disrupts connection.
Yeah.
How can you create connection? And so let's talk about the role the arts are to do that.
Yeah.
And when I say the arts, I mean the arts in two broad ways. Arts as witnessed In other words, sit, and as you will all do in 2 weeks, at the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society's production of A Song by Mahler at the Perelman Theater at the Kimmel Center. No, seriously, you will, because that's that'll be a very cathartic experience for you. So there's arts as witness, and then there's arts as participatory, doing of art. So talk about how the arts can address some of the dementia aspects of how to live with and cope with dementia blindness.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that arts does is that it restores this very profound lacking and hunger in both the person who has the disease and the caregiver. We talk a lot about the person who has the disease, their isolation, the changes in their brain. But as I mentioned, dealing with dementia symptoms means a constant reminder that you no longer have a connection. You no longer have this mutual world that we all desperately want. And I think that the beauty of the arts is that you can, once again, create a shared world just by listening to music. All of a sudden, it doesn't require any cognitive strain on either one. The family dramas, the wounds, they could go away because all of a sudden you're both having this mutual connection of listening to music, especially if it's music that has captivated both of you in the past. And I think that there's nothing more humanizing than that. To seeing somebody you love connected to the arts is so profound. And dealing with somebody who has dementia, why it's so traumatizing for caregivers is oftentimes you're used to doing a lot of things that are dehumanizing, like taking driving privileges away, like making decisions on their behalf. And it's horrible to see people you love in a diminished state. But when you see them engage in arts and in music, there's something so humanizing because that does, it ties them again back into a world where we all belong.
Yeah, no, I'm reminded for Arts on the Mind a week or two ago, we were at the Woodmere Museum with Susan Schifrin and colleagues of Arts Philadelphia. And one of our many events at that museum was sitting before a painting. We weren't told the title. And Susan asked us essentially to compose a poem as a group. Based on what we saw. And we didn't know who was patient. And again, I use these terms. I'm a doctor. I bill for them. But we didn't know who was patient. We didn't know who was caregiver. But what we knew was we were all able to sit and look at this painting and say what we saw. And then out of that, she put together a poem. I think another example of an experiential moment of the arts where there was that connection. Anne Basting, back in early March over at the Franklin Institute, talked about the work she's done with creative care, using the creative arts, the fundamental idea of improv comedy. You know, yes, and I've heard what you said, and I will now ask tell me more. I think these are all moments where examples of how the arts can be used to create that connection.
I
wanted to put out one of the if one of the problems is that we're human, and it is a problem.
Such a problem.
Yeah, and not robots, thank God, or I think the new term now is large language networks. I believe that's what...
Yikes.
Yeah, because I don't know what a robot is. I think your work, as I left, showed the tremendous opportunity to create a workforce of professional caregivers. Because professional caregivers, people who really have read your book and my book, and thought about this, are able to create, and dare I say, some degree of distance. In other words, they much like, and I'll use a very pejorative example, but I think it hammers it home, people who are really good at childcare.
Right.
Yeah. You know, they're not the parents.
Yes.
And yet you trust your kids with them because they get your kid, they figure it out, et cetera. And we don't really have that workforce. If you said, you know, I want to go to college, I'm going to be a professional caregiver, they'd say, well, oh, so you're going to go into real estate, drop out, and then look for another job, et cetera, which is, I mean, and it's a sad testament. In fact, the closest to people who are professional caregivers are certified nurse's assistants. And their job is framed as you're there to assist the nurse to do BADL care, bathing, dressing, grooming. And that's the one, you know, and then you're left with, in social work, you know, somewhat, there's no profession that has really said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to help people connect with and care for a mind that's been damaged by a disease. So I think that's a great opportunity. We could make a major at a school for it.
I wish there would be. I work for an organization where their specialty is basically, it's like matchmaking, where they take folks who are interested in people living with dementia, and they oftentimes come from the world of arts or you know, and they link them based on personality matches. And the goal is to get away from that medical model where all you need to do is provide safety for that person, because that's so profoundly dehumanizing. I think what arts always tells us is that our purpose is to really create meaning, connection, purpose, and instead of treating somebody with dementia as an object to keep alive, to say that these people have so much capacity, so much cognitive reserve, why are we there just keeping them alive instead of creating a world that's still worth living? And people who are professionals are oftentimes so much better than family. I really tell family, I'm like, for the sake of your sanity, bring somebody in, because they don't have the baggage you do with your mom. And they might open up your mom in a way that she would never open up to you, mostly because she
or your
might,
wife or your husband, wife, or your
because
partner,
there are certain, you know, there are family patterns that continue on, even with dementia. They might want to look a certain way to their daughters, and they might be sillier or more open or share more with a stranger who's, you know, who they have good chemistry with. And all of a sudden, people who are really good at this work, they like it. They're not, they don't feel like they're babysitting.
I agree. It's very interesting, the reward they get, along with some good cash too.
Yes.
We're going to take questions and answers. So at some point, a microphone is going to appear. And I've really enjoyed this conversation. And I do want to say, in this city in particular, the opportunities for the arts, because we have an unusual concentration of really world-class arts organizations and spaces like libraries, where, you know, during the day at an arts organization, when they're not performing, there are so many opportunities for programming that could address this.
Yeah.
Just across the street is the Barnes Museum, which, you know, during the day on a weekday is, for example, is a great space on Tuesdays for community education. So I just like you all to think about the many opportunities in our own city here, the opera, the Chamber Music Society, the Franklin Institute. I mean, we could run the list, the PAFA, it's really marvelous.
Right.
So question.
Okay, I have an avocation as a humanitarian clown. And there are actually groups, mostly in Europe, who go into, you know, hospitals or places where people with dementia are. And first of all, they will dress up in sort of the clothing that the person they're visiting would have seen or would have worn years ago. And they just give the person a terrific experience. You know, the person they're working with is the star, and they do things for that person.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really been, or I've also been in a singing group and, you know, getting people to sing, you know, the old songs.
Yeah,
you mentioned a group called, what are they called?
It's called The Unforgettables, the choir. And it's one of the most moving things I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where caregivers
mentioning.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Having the arts be a form of connection between the two the two people, I wonder how often in your experience it happens that the patient has a love of opera, and the caregiver, maybe of a different generation, loves rap music. And so you're trying to make a connection through music, but there's really no common ground in that situation. And if so, do you come up with another art that you find that both people can appreciate, or do you have...
You go to the O2 Festival where I find the opera to be very progressive. What do you think?
I don't know. I was looking.
Let's be honest. You just say, well, that's all the more reason for the role for professional caregivers. Like, you know, I can't stand opera, but, you know, you, all right, fine. Off you go to Madame Butterfly, which I think is coming up.
Right.
I'll stay home and listen to rap. But I find that a very just practical, pragmatic solution.
Yeah.
You know?
I say they both should do what they love, because I think that it doesn't always have to be together, but when but art fills you up, and once it does, it makes you more open to connection. You know, I always tell, because I'm usually dealing with caregivers, and my general approach is, please get out of the house. Not everything has to be with the person you're taking care of. Replenish yourself with art. In fact, caregivers I know have taken improv courses, and the reason that they became better to their mother is not because they learned how to yes and, but because they got a community and having that connection gave her more emotional space to be flexible with her mom. And so I say all the arts, you can do them together, but also do it separately. You know, each one deserves that self-care.
I've been craving conversations like this, so I really appreciate it. Not going to get emotional. So I was really curious what you had to say about the delay that caregivers have in making difficult decisions for people. Yeah. And if you had creative ideas, I was not going to get emotional with a microphone, but whatever. if you had ideas about creative ways for that, and also, or if anyone does, and also another part of that is a lot of the shame that the person experiencing dementia feels about. Yeah. I know amongst my mom's community, people talk about, oh, so-and-so is losing their mind. And I hear my godfather say things, they have a lot of shame and stigma around it, which is, obviously a part of a bigger thing in our society of ignoring aging or thinking it's terrible. But I was just curious about that.
So a two-part question that you want to...
If I understand the two-part question, one is, how do you make decisions?
Yeah, just about you were talking about procrastinating.
Yeah, avoiding that.
So how do you make decisions? Yeah, I've had a lot of caregivers call me, and they're like, and it's sometimes as small as whether I should take my father to a Thanksgiving, or as big as should I take my dad to do surgery. And I think that the one thing to do is not to feel rushed. And the fact that you're calling and talking to somebody is actually already a great thing, because we're not meant to make decisions for people. This is why it's so loaded for you, and why I would get teary as well. We are biologically made to make decisions with people, because that's what we do. We're supposed to connect. So talk to somebody who you trust and go through the various options and talk about what does each decision bring up to you, for you? And I think that one of the things is to know that because this disease is so profoundly unfair, a lot of the times none of these decisions feel good or are good. And that's why we procrastinate, because we think, oh, maybe I could get it just right. But the truth is that there are very few right decisions. So what you need is somebody supporting you, talking to you, giving you empathic questions, so you could kind of get toned into what your viscera is telling you, right? And the only way you could do it is through a conversation, is through a connection with somebody who you trust and who deserves your trust. And only then, with time, you'll be like, okay, this is the least bad option.
Yeah. There's an essay that I read early in my training in my graduate work was, medicine is a tragic profession. The danger of that is, of course, it gives you an excuse for sort of outcomes that are bad, but there is a tragedy to medicine, and if there's one area of medicine that amplifies that, it's dementia. Having said that, and not rejecting it, I sound like a lawyer. the problem with stigma is dreadful, and I guess I will give you, we'll wrap on a note of hope, which is that we're here today. Talking like this about
That's
this,
right.
And you're here, and because we couldn't have done this 5-10 years ago.
No.
I have hope. Actually, I'm very cautiously optimistic. The fact that this festival is going on, the fact that you're here today, that slowly the arc of history is bending towards kind of a justice towards living with a mind that is affected by these diseases and caring for it, as opposed to hiding it, stigmatizing it, and all the other behaviors that lead to the problems that patients and families face. So
I
do have hope. Small hope, but I have hope.
And I'm so grateful that you mentioned the stigma, because I say, find what I found that gives people hope is find other people who are experiencing the exact same thing. Like, I can never fix, there's nothing I could say that could rid you of guilt or stigma or anything like that. But when you find a community where you feel it together, and in fact, what you're doing is giving them a gift, because what you're going to do is make them feel validated. And that's exactly what they're not getting at home, validation. And so I say, find your community who could give you that, where you could share your anger, your stigma, your confusion, all the things that are in your heart. And this will be just as good for you as it is for others, because you're going to make other people feel less alone. And that, by nature, lowers stigma.
We are at time.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, oh. Alas. Having said that, we'll be upstairs.
We'll be upstairs. Come to us.
All right, we'll give one more question. Go ahead. Last question.
Well, I have a complex situation. I'm just beginning to learn about dementia.
Yeah.
Alzheimer's, you really didn't talk too much about that disease. What is Alzheimer's? What is that? My uncle had it.
Yeah. So Alzheimer's is, and we'll wrap on this, Alzheimer's is a disease of the brain. It's caused by at least two pathologies, two disorders, two amyloid plaques and tau tangles. A pathologist will see that under the microscope. A radiologist can see it with an imaging scan. And for reasons that are still a bit mysterious, those two abnormalities start out in certain regions of the brain, cause those regions of the brain to not work as well, often the memory regions initially, where we learn and remember things. And the result is dementia, namely disabling cognitive impairments. So Alzheimer's is a disease of the brain that causes dementia. Another disease of the brain is Lewy body disease, named after Dr. Lewy. That was his name. And it's caused by a pathology called, just bear with me, alpha-synuclein, completely different than Alzheimer's, different pathology, different set of symptoms, same overall problem, though, namely dementia, disabling cognitive and emotional and behavioral problems as well.
So right. That's now, dementia is before Alzheimer's.
Nope.
Is that correct?
Alzheimer's is the disease that causes dementia.
Okay.
Yeah. Just like Haemophilus influenza is the virus that causes influenza.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. See you upstairs.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.